You're listening to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And today we start the show by talking about short-term rentals and the effects they have on communities and the wider housing market. Expert with us, Anthony Pennington Cross, is a professor of finance at Marquette University. He's the Robert B. Bell Senior Chair in Real Estate, and his research focuses on subprime lending in the housing market, house price dynamics, commercial property fundamentals, and other urban and real estate issues. And before coming to Marquette, Anthony was a senior economist in the research division at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. So as we talk with Anthony, I hope you'll join in with your questions about the rental or the housing market. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Anthony Pennington Cross, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for inviting me on the show. Just so you know, most people here at Marquette, they just call me by my initials because my name's a little cumbersome. So if you want, you can call me APC like most of Wisconsin does, if you like.
All right. Well, first, let's define a term here. What's a short-term rental?
Right. So, you know, if we think about short-term rentals, it's an alternative to staying at a hotel or motel. And so it's of a similar duration. So it could be a day, it could be a couple weeks, and that's kind of the typical range, a day to a week or two.
And they've certainly gained popularity, especially I think after the platforms Airbnb and Vrbo, which I had to look Vrbo up because I couldn't remember what the acronym was, but it's Vacation Rentals by Owner is what it means. How long have short-term rentals influenced the housing market?
Well, I could tell you in Wisconsin, so if you look back at the number of hosts, that's the verbiage that at least that Airbnb uses. Mm-hmm. So in 2016, there were 200 hosts in Milwaukee. And by 2018, there were about 1,200. Okay? So kind of pre-2016, you know, going back to about 2012 or so, there were 10, 20, 30, 40 hosts in our region. And then there was an explosion this is when the Democrats wanted to come to Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And right? That was a big explosion of Airbnb for this region.
So that's been a big growth and over the last 5 years.
Yeah, but it's kind of, you know, when we hit COVID, it's kind of flattened out, right? So that kind of super rapid growth of, you know, 40-50% every year has been, you know, it's still growing, but, you know, kind of single digit growth. So I looked up for Milwaukee the number of hosts today. And according to there's a website called AirDNA. If anyone's interested in Airbnb, you should. I have no relationship, but they're a data scraping company. So they go to Airbnb and they scrape the data and they provide free summary information. And so they report that the number of hosts today in Milwaukee was 1,400, which is not much different than the 1,200 in 2018. So you can kind of see it's kind of flattened out.
So. I'm thinking of why do people choose them? Why choose a short-term rental as maybe opposed to a hotel or motel? Price, I imagine, might be an issue, or what other factors are involved?
Yeah, so I think pricing is an important piece. So in general, short-term rental is going to be a little bit cheaper. It's also a larger variety of types of accommodation. You know, this could be a bed in a room and a house, right? And so you get access to the room and the house. So that's kind of the bottom end. Or you could be renting a full home, right? A townhome downtown, right? So there's a huge variety in quality and amount of space that you're going to be able to rent. So I think one of the other reasons people rent through Airbnb or VRBO is, you know, you're likely to have a kitchen.
Yeah.
Right? And so you have a place where you can make food for breakfast. You don't have to go out. And so you get extra flexibility there. You know, and it was a new thing. So I think people are having fun trying these things out also.
Yeah. Right?
So that was kind of at the beginning of this process also.
I know as a few years back, our producer, Jill Nadeau, who lives in Watertown, wanted to start an Airbnb on. And at the time I thought, is she going to make any money on this at all? And it turns out her, of course, she has a very nice place.
Yep.
And you know, with full kitchen and all that. But and also, she spent a lot of time on making sure the accoutrements, the beds, the couches, and all that are first rate. And she's just doing fantastic with it.
Yeah, I think it's surprising. You know, you don't have to be occupied all the time. It's not necessarily – it's not really a full-time job, and it can really be a meaningful supplement to your income and to your life.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's one of the main positives that comes out of this, that there are people like your friend, right, who have more income than they would have had, right? And, yes, there's a disruption when people come and go, and you have to take care of them and text them and call them, right, make sure they're doing okay. But you don't have to actually meet them in person. It can be kind of a third-party relationship.
Yeah.
So you know, they're on the – you know, one of the things we show in our research and other people have shown, you know, definitely brings income into the community. And so income and spending kind of increases around Airbnbs.
Yeah. Marianne in Middleton just has a comment. Let's go there. Marianne, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we utilized Airbnb in our process of moving from La Crosse to Middleton. We have a school-age son, who was participating in virtual education, and we had our sights on moving to the Madison area when COVID kind of stopped us in our tracks. And we had our son going to school virtually the fall semester of 2020, but then schools opened up in the beginning of 2021, and we wanted to get him to the Madison area where he was registered for school. And we crippled through that beginning first half of 2021 by staying at three separate Airbnbs for month-long rentals that were just – they were such a lifesaver for us because we could make meals and our son could participate in school – and we didn't have to haul our travel piano and everything. We could leave something there, you know?
Well, you know, and she mentions COVID there. Marianne mentions COVID. And that sounds like a great story and why she chose it. But what did the coronavirus pandemic and also remote work impact the market?
Yeah, so... If we compare to what happened to the hotels and the motels, Airbnb did much, much better. And so if we went back and look at occupancy rates for hotels and motels when COVID first hit, you know, we were going from 80% occupied down to 10 and 20, and places were being shut down. So Airbnb also saw a pretty steep drop off. I don't have the number right in front of me. But there was a substantial drop off in, especially in urban areas. But quickly, we saw that, you know, people needed a place to go for a break, right? And so, kind of the nicer locations, the places on the lake, on the ocean, in the mountains, those type of vacation or funner places than where we typically live, right? Those places did very well, and those were huge growth. Places for Airbnb and VRBO during COVID. You know, those have kind of come back, and the cities have kind of rebounded since then. But that's been kind of the path for them.
Yeah, I had a friend who did that several times. They went to Airbnbs that were situated, you know, like right next to the wonderful site that they want. You know, they're looking out their Airbnb at a mountain or whatever. which you might not be able to get with a hotel.
Yeah, yeah. So you get in more, you can get in more unique and more remote locations, right? With some Airbnbs. I can tell you that during COVID, we rented an Airbnb up by Sleeping Bear Dunes in upstate Michigan. So that's a perfect example, right? We didn't have to go to the all I have to do is go to the shopping center to get some food. We were set. We didn't, you know, all the interaction pieces were gone, and we were just outside walking in the dunes. And so I think that's what we did is a classic example.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Joe in Rice Lake, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Joe, thanks.
Hey, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. So this is kind of a NIMBY type of question, not in my backyard. I live in beautiful northwest Wisconsin on a small lake, and all of a sudden I have an Airbnb, VRBO, two doors down from me, and the owners are from Iowa, putting three more bedrooms in. And all of a sudden, this beautiful residential area becomes a vacation rental environment. I'm wondering, are properties of this nature taxed as a residence or as a business, which it really is, because it's a non-resident property owner from out of state? And I'm just, it's definitely maybe not in my backyard kind of a question, but I'm just wondering if you have any background on the tax liability.
Yeah, Joe, I'm glad you called because you raised a few issues there. APC, you want to comment?
Yeah, sure. So when we think about Airbnb, there are a lot of things that happen there that are against the kind of the rules of the neighborhood and the rules of the city. So in some of the big cities, it's estimated that the vast majority of the Airbnbs there are, you know, technically illegal, right? So in some cities you have to, there's a lot of regulations in some places. They have to register. There are some cities which have responded to issues like you're concerned with by banning Airbnb. So like Berlin has done that. And they're doing that for the exact reasons that you are concerned about. So just the concerns of taking a residential area and turning it into a, you know, a visitor's area. And in some areas, there's just been complete switching areas from all the residents are out, right? And it's just all short-term rentals. So in terms of the taxes, it's very likely that they're not being taxed as a business. They are hopefully they're reporting their income, right, as a business, but that property is likely being treated as a single family property, and they're paying their property taxes in that manner. That's very likely.
You wonder, and kind of the other part of this, here's Joe, he's got a house on a lake, and suddenly he's got two doors down, he's got an Airbnb. How does that affect the value of his property?
Yeah, so there's kind of two things going on. One is your concern, right, the nuisance concern.
Yeah.
And so I think this is a legitimate concern that I have. You know, people behave differently when they're on vacation and in someone else's home than when in your own home. And typically people behave worse when they're in a hotel or an Airbnb. That can be inconsistent with the character of the neighborhood. You could think of people in the hot tub out late at night. It's Tuesday night. You know, it's midnight, and you know everyone else is going to sleep because they have to go off to work the next day. So there's definitely conflict going on there. So that's kind of the negative. So that could reduce the value of the neighbors around the Airbnb. On the positive side, we kind of mentioned before, right? So bringing income into the neighborhood, the visitors going out to the restaurants, going to the boutiques, all those things, right? So those are kind of gentrification processes. So there's evidence that Airbnb helps to kind of gentrify areas. On the other hand, it can definitely be a nuisance, and this can especially be true if it's like an Airbnb. So there's really, so Barcelona has a famous soccer team, right? Yeah. And there's tons of Airbnb in Barcelona. And one of the problems is the behavior of the soccer fans after Barcelona loses is quite bad. And so Airbnb plays a role in Barcelona went of the partying going negative after the game. So that's kind of the worst case scenario. So that was interesting paper that I read. But on net, Airbnb drives up house prices.
Drives them up.
And I'll give you the number for Wisconsin, since we're in Wisconsin, and that's the one of the papers that I wrote. So if we double the number of Airbnbs in a neighborhood, house prices go up about 10-11%. Okay?
Wow.
And that impact is going to be bigger, I think, like our caller, in places like that. Because there's zoning, you can't do building, it's fully occupied already. So that's where the impact on the pricing is the largest. In the most urban areas, so like in downtown Milwaukee, it doesn't have any impact because there's enough housing stock in place, and there are areas that need gentrification, right? So mm-hmm. bringing more people is not crowding out existing folks and increasing demand where there's room for more supply. And that's not going to be true on the lakefronts and the places it sounds like our caller is coming from.
Yeah. Joe, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. APC, Anthony Pennington Cross, our guest today, professor of finance at Marquette University. Talking with him today about the impact of short-term rentals, the Airbnbs and the Vrbos, and what they might have on your community. Our producer today, by the way, is Clara Neipert, and our engineer, Trina LaSousa. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Anthony Pennington Cross, our guest today, professor of finance at Marquette University, as we talk with him about the short-term rental market and its impact on communities everywhere, but specifically here in Wisconsin, we're zeroing in a bit on here, of course, with him. Our lines are all full, so let's take a call from Tom in Walworth County. Hi, Tom.
Hey, in terms of short-term rentals, I'm in a small association, Lakeside, a smaller lake, and we had one Chicago neighbor go Airbnb 10 years ago when it was against the law, before Scott Walker just blanket opened it up. And it had its moments of being a nightmare. And in my estimation and what I've witnessed, short-term rentals degrade the fabric of any neighborhood. And then you set the neighbors against each other because some are okay with it, some are very vocally against it, and that's where we're at. Luckily, this home has recently gone on the market, and I won't bore you with all the details, but we've been witnessing short-term rental nightmare.
Yeah, that's one of those where maybe Tom and the neighbors get together and buy that house. Oh, boy. So comment on that,
yeah,
APC?
Yeah. Yeah, Tom, you know, I think you brought up an important point that from the Airbnb perspective, one of the most Airbnb-friendly states in the United States is Wisconsin. So we're one of the easiest places to start an Airbnb and the lightest regulation. So I think that, you know, that there's a continuum there, right? Almost no regulation. That's pretty much where we are. And then, you know, places like San Francisco are it's very, very heavily regulated. Of course, unfortunately, compliance with the regulations is not always forthcoming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom, I'm sorry for your experience. But here again, Tom is talking about what you described just a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
In a situation like there's no other property available and...
Yeah, and there, I mean, like I was saying before, right? When you're on vacation, you may not act well, and yeah. So there can be negative spillovers. And it sounds like they have a semi-absent owner / landlord. You know, if we kind of go back to like the starting point for Airbnb, it was kind of, you know, Airbnb stands for, you know, an air mattress. That's how it started, right? It was a couple guys. They were like I don't think they were getting engineering degrees. There was a conference in town, and their friends couldn't come to the conference. So they put air mattresses out, and they posted it on the conference website, and then they filled up. And they're like, okay, let's put air mattresses in our houses, and people can come, right, when they wouldn't be able to come otherwise. So it kind of started off in this kind of on-the-side business for existing homeowners, and it's morphed into a real big business. And so, can change total. There are definitely whole neighborhoods whose character has completely changed, where it used to be residents and now it's completely visitors. And so, I would suggest that neighborhoods address this. How much Airbnb do you want? Is there any capacity for you to force any kind of at least telling us that there's an Airbnb here, providing information to the local municipality. So I support, see if you could get that conversation going if you're having any trouble with a local Airbnb.
Just as an aside on this, could a community supersede the state regulations? Or could a community say, we're not having any Airbnb, so if you can't have one in our neighborhood?
But I want to make sure to let you know that I don't really know. So
okay.
I'm not sure who supersedes what. But I would recommend starting that process and asking for compliance. Because enforcement's hard, but if you could work as a neighborhood and ask for information at least from existing Airbnbs, then that could be useful, I think.
Nancy in Madison, let's go to you now. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I have a couple of comments and questions. Is there any way for these municipalities to distinguish between the private equity groups that are coming in and buying whole neighborhoods and turning them into short-term rentals, and even like hotels are getting involved, the Marriott Group, Hyatt, they're coming in and buying homes, single-family homes, and renting them out as though they're an extension of their hotel brand. And for me, as a host, I'm a single-family homeowner, and I'm trying to keep my father out of a nursing home. So the way that I do that is to supplement my income by renting out my home, and I have to say, it's reaffirmed my faith in humanity in a lot of ways. I think just the opposite. People treat my home as though it's their own, and many of them have become friends, and it's so affordable for families to get together also, because like here in a university town like Madison, the hotels on parents' weekends charge $800, upwards of $800 a night for a queen bed. And when families can be together as one and be able to, use the amenities, as you've said, about having a kitchen and having more quality time together in a safe environment, that is way more affordable. Like, for example, $300 a night for a whole house as opposed to $800 a night for a hotel room. And we also have to report now any income over $600 a year has to be declared. So there's a lot of taxes that are being paid by the hosts, and the guests pay taxes as well. And I'm wondering if, as our property taxes rise, our municipal fees rise, short-term rentals aren't causing that. The inability to tax the 1% in this country are. And so this is an affordable way for me to hang on to the equity of my house, take care of my father, and while my home isn't occupied, have responsible people who've been vetted to stay there. And I haven't had any terrible experiences. In fact, it's been just the opposite. I've been so wonderfully surprised by how wonderful people really can be and forging those relationships. And just one other point, that the licensing, there are licensing fees, there are home inspections to get licensed for Airbnb, the Department of Health Services comes in, there might be a building inspection. So this isn't some fly-by-night thing. And
yeah.
If you could, in particular, talk about, you know, the private equity groups are the real problem, buying up these neighborhoods and buying up the a lot of the quality properties on the lakes that mm-hmm. other callers have mentioned. And how can we distinguish between the use purposes of why people are hosts?
So it's a day. Here's Nancy has, I think, somewhat similar situation to many. You know, here, well, I'm thinking of Jill Nadeau, our producer here in Watertown, who has, who, you know, she's not it's not a big conglomerate. She's got this one duplex that is, you know, and has often commented to me that her guests have been really nice, and she's made some friends. People come back, and so forth, just as Nancy has said.
Yeah, I think, Nancy, you brought up a whole, like, at least three really important things there. And so I think the first one that Larry's kind of touching on is this doing an Airbnb is a moment of trust between two people, right? And so that can be a bonding moment when you fulfill that trust. And, you know, it's in some sense, it's very reaffirming. I mean, I heard the news before, before your show got started, right? I mean, there were things kind of bad things happening, right? That kind of erode trust. And sometimes these, you know, these activities help to build the trust. So it's always nice to hear positive pieces. Also, you know, feedback, right? When you do these things, you rate the home and the rent, and then Nancy, you know, kind of rates the renter. And so there is some kind of, you know, quality control, making sure that people are fulfilling their responsibilities. The kind of the corp. So you asked about, you know, the corp. I would just call them the corporate Airbnb entities buying up swaths of homes. Unfortunately, you know, one thing it's very difficult to do in the United States is to actually know who owns a piece of property. It's because we can create trust or these entities, and then the entity owns it, and it's hard to get past the trust and understand who is the owners of the trust, right? And so it's very difficult to know who owns what. Right. So for me, you can go find my home and look it up. And you'll see my last name. Right. I have a unique last name, so I'm easy to find in there. But for a lot of the corporate ownerships, there's a kind of a veil there. And makes it very difficult to know who actually the owners of these different properties are. So that creates a lot of issues. So I think that's a very difficult thing to control, is if it needs to be controlled, how corporate entities are involved. And then last, you talk about, you know, why we need Airbnb is to provide this flexible supply of short-term renting when there's a huge increase in temporary, large increase in demand for space. And so you talk about that, like graduation or down here where I live, right? It could be
Republicans coming to Milwaukee. Yeah,
that's another. So I would assert we couldn't have the RNC, the DNC in this area. It'd be very difficult without places like VRBO and Airbnb.
Yeah, right?
That's why they can come here, because now we have enough beds.
Yeah, Nancy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate those comments. Bob in Madison, let's go to you, Bob. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Larry. Hi, APC. My husband and I own two small hospitality businesses in downtown Madison. And 2 years ago, Airbnb opened their platform for renting out rooms in small hotels and small bed and breakfasts. And that's worked out tremendously for us. But I would say maybe 6 or 7 years ago, we did work with the city on establishing tighter regulations on what are generically known as transient rooming houses in Madison. And as you know, it's a local municipality that enforces the Wisconsin state law on the transient rooming houses, the Airbnbs. And here, you have to live on site in a TRH or a B&B to be able to rent it out. And if you don't live on site, you're only allowed to rent out for 30 days per year. And that has curtailed a lot of the nefarious Airbnb, VRBO activities that we've seen out there. The city does hire a consultant to do research on what Airbnbs are out there and correlate them with the local registrations, and they use the zoning inspection to enforce all that. So that's the situation in Madison.
Yeah, and so and you're also telling me then that the local municipalities do have the power to make rules and regulations and so forth. APC, comment?
No, I think I think you've given the roadmap to our one of our earlier callers. That's what you just did.
Yeah,
right? And so your local town sounds. So I'm not a lawyer, so this is a real weakness for me. But you've definitely given a roadmap for providing some control over Airbnb. For me, Airbnb is good in some places, and it's okay in smaller amounts. But there can be too many, right? There's kind of a density. There can be density problems, right, where you change characters of neighborhoods. There you go.
And I think as we were talking, the number has just ballooned of Airbnbs, Verbos, or whatever. That has probably, it's sort of like I'm thinking about farming now. You get an oversupply of corn and the price of corn drops. I imagine if you get an oversupply of Airbnbs, the price drops. And
yeah. I mean, the great thing with Airbnb, it's relatively easy to enter and become a host, and it's and inexpensive. It's relatively easy to exit, right? And so that's important. So I'm trained as an economist. I'm describing a perfect market right there, right? If people can get in the market and out of the market quickly. Of course, there's some cost to enter, but exiting is pretty low and much lower than a hotel. And so that's how that's how we can have the RNC and the DNC, and we can have Summerfest and all these things in smaller states like Wisconsin.
Al in Winter, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, sir. We live immediately next door to a VRBO on a small, approximately 120-acre lake. We bought the property in 1976 with the idea that at some point this would be our retirement home, which it is. And with those expectations, we knew that there would be some year-round homes and maybe, certainly a number of seasonal homes until this VRBO came in next door. Most of the folks there are friendly and polite. However, it's like living next door to a hotel. This place is occupied probably, on average, 5 to 6 months a year, and that's 7 days a week with anywhere from maybe 2 to 10 to 15 people. So there's this constant movement in an area that we kind of hoped would be considerably more quiet.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, that's a challenge, right? And that's the change in the character of the neighborhood. And just FYI, that VR, a lot of listings are on both VRBO and Airbnb, so there can be some non-trivial overlap of those two types of listings. I would say that VRBO in general is considered to be a little better quality, so a better house, probably something next to you, Al. Right. And so rather than the Airbnb.
So yep. There is a difference in that, or it can be a difference, I guess.
There can be. There's a lot of overlap, but in general, it's a bigger, nicer place in general for VRBO.
So as we look at the future on this, are we going to see more? Or what are you predicting, or are you predicting anything relating to the future of this. I mean, I worry sometimes about if you, depending on how many come in or whatever, it could have an impact on things like low-income housing, for example. Or it could have an impact on the number of homes or occupancies or rentals, year lease kind of rentals that exist in a community.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of evidence that kind of on the multifamily side, it's a little this sometimes. So a typical kind of successful multifamily development today would often include some Airbnb, right? And mm-hmm. So you're substituting Airbnb short-term rentals for the longer-term rentals, right? And so that restricts the supply of rentals for residents, right? Versus rentals for visitors, and so that's why rents tend to increase when there's Airbnb around, because it's moving a little bit of the stock for the multifamily. And, you know, that's part of the reason the house prices go up also, right? So it's a little bit about supply and a demand component. So, you know, my take is Airbnb is here. It's going to stay. I think its rapid growth period is coming to an end. But I think we're going to continue to see pressure, right, and more Airbnbs in places like Wisconsin around our beautiful lakes. And so just, you know, with Alan, you know, these are real issues, these externalities. And if you want that to stop or at least have some control over it or to limit the number of days, right, as we heard before from an earlier caller, you know, it sounds like that's something your municipality can work towards to kind of minimize the externalities on the neighbors. But, you know, in general, I think it's here to stay. And I also anticipate it'll be increasingly regulated over time because of some of the issues that we heard today on your show.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, Anthony. And well, I tell you what, we could talk about interest rates with you sometime, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe too. That might make another show. I'd love to have you back. Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
I wanted to thank the callers. It was nice to talk to anyone, and nice to see you in person, or at least virtually, Larry.
Thanks, Anthony. All right. APC, Anthony Pennington Cross, Professor of Finance at Marquette University, the Robert B. Bell Senior Chair in Real Estate at Marquette. It was fun talking with him. And I imagine we'll get him back for one way or another down the road. In the meantime, I'm looking ahead to what's coming up in the next minute or two, and that has to do with smoking. CDC says it's still the leading cause of preventable death and disease and disability in the United States. And we'll talk about quitting with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As I mentioned, the CDC says cigarette smoking is the leading cause of preventable death, disease, and disability in the U.S. And maybe you're one of those people who's looking to quit, or maybe you have a loved one you'd love to have quit smoking or just quit tobacco. Larry Mueller here. We'll spend the rest of today's show talking about quitting tobacco with our guest, Dr. Doug Jorenby. He's Director of Clinical Services for the UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's held the role since the center began in 1992. So maybe you're trying to quit tobacco. What questions do you have about cigarettes or chew or vaping addiction? We want you to be part of the conversation, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Doug Jordanby, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for asking me to join you, Larry.
So earlier this month, a study from the Wisconsin Policy Forum found that Wisconsin cigarette sales have fallen significantly over the last 20 years. And so maybe why the decline in sales?
Well, the forum report kind of pointed at two factors that are very, very real and relevant. One is simply that during that 20 years, cigarettes became more expensive. A lot of that came from state taxes and federal taxes, but also, you know, increase in price from the tobacco companies who sell them. And we've known for a long, long time that the more expensive cigarettes are, the fewer of them get smoked, even by people who are, you know, regular daily smokers. But it has a particular impact on helping keep young people from starting to smoke in the first place because they're so price sensitive. So that's obviously a big chunk. The other thing they pointed to was, again, during that same 20-year period, we saw some incredible and to my mind, almost unbelievable. I would say, as somebody who's lived in Wisconsin for decades, I never actually believed we were going to see the day where taverns in Wisconsin would be smoke-free, and yet it happened. And that not only, you know, protected the health of people who work in restaurants and taverns and other public spaces, and the people that patronize them, but it also sent a real strong message that, you know, smoking is not the default. It's not something that everybody does all the time. And it's kind of shocking. You were gracious enough in your introduction to mention how long I've been doing this. And it's kind of embarrassing that back in the early to mid-90s, when I stepped into my role with the center here, you know, people were lighting up in the atrium, in the lobby, in private offices at UW Hospital and Clinics, right? A place that's world-class in terms of protecting and improving people's health, and yet there was smoking going on all the time in all kinds of places. So those two things are what the forum pointed out, and they both made a big contribution. I would add, too, that, again, overlapping almost exactly with that period of time, we also made something available to everyone in the state of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Tobacco Quitline, that I'm pleased to say is still in operation. It's still helping people all through the state quit by providing them with, you know, counseling and support at no charge. And for people who are ready to quit, even providing them with 2 weeks of nicotine gum, nicotine lozenge, or nicotine patches to help them through the toughest part of quitting, that the first couple weeks from the withdrawal symptoms. So that also has contributed to fewer people smoking and fewer cigarettes being bought.
As we were talking, I was thinking back to my own, because it was about 25 years ago, I quit smoking, and I work with Mike Fiore, Dr. Mike Fiore from, and I don't know if you may remember this or not, but I did the quitting smoking by going through the program that you folks have or had at the time. And once a week, Mike Fiore would come on the show for a month, and we'd talk about it. And I had about 150 or so people, listeners, kind of sign up to do it, too. And I don't know how many of them quit, but I did, and I haven't smoked a cigarette in probably 25 years.
Fantastic. Congratulations. Yes, I do remember that as well. The only thing is 25 years puts you just outside of the boundaries of where the Wisconsin Forum was looking. So we can't technically call it the Larry Mueller, you know, wave.
You can't count me.
Right. But you should take credit for it anyway. I think it's worth it.
Oh, well, it was certainly a great and positive change in my life. That's for sure. And yeah. It's hard. It's so, I mean, people say, I have never, you know, they've been on heroin, but some people have said it's harder to quit smoking than quitting heroin or maybe even cocaine.
Oh, and that's not just anecdotal. There's a lot of good data to back that up. You know, if you look at people who are dependent on multiple substances, almost without exception, smoking, tobacco, nicotine, however we want to label it, is usually the one that they give up last. And it's also the one that the people say is the most difficult for them. And part of that has to do with the way nicotine works, but it also has something to do with, you know, the way that it gets integrated. When you think back to your life, you know, 26 years ago,
yeah,
before you started the groundswell of quitting, I mean, was there much that you did day to day that didn't involve lighting up a cigarette?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, if you're talking about someone who smokes a pack a day, that's tens of thousands of puffs that someone will take in the course of a year. And it gets wrapped up in just about everything. There are a few lines that don't get crossed. I remember working with a group of people who were quitting together years ago, and one person talked about how it was really hard for them in the morning to not smoke when they were taking their shower. and literally everyone else in the group around the table looked at them like they were a Martian. But they weren't making it up. They said that they would, you know, stand in the shower and hold the one hand with the cigarette out beyond the curtain and take a puff. But other than that, yeah, it does. It gets wrapped up in so many things. And again, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, before there were so many smoke-free public places, it was also something that you could do. You know, even the way people sometimes disparage Madison, people are not, you know, shooting up heroin on State Street.
Yeah.
But it was perfectly fine to light up a cigarette on the street. Yeah, in the shops, in the restaurants, anywhere, you name it.
Yeah. So what does it do to the brain anyway?
Well, it does a variety of things, some of which are pretty appealing, especially in the short term. You know, nicotine is definitely a stimulant. And we've also been seeing now in more recent years, as we've been able to do neuroimaging kind of work, that it seems to interact with the experience of pleasure. It's not necessarily a feel-good chemical in its own right, if you will, but it seems to heighten the anticipation of doing things that will be pleasurable. It certainly is helpful to people doing what is a wonderful bit of academic argle-bargle in the cognitive literature that are called boring high vigilance tasks. And I'm sure neither one of us
like
can
that
think
one
of those. The example I always use is before everything became digital and computerized, if you remember what air traffic controllers did, you know, there were dozens and dozens of them sitting in these dark rooms staring at radar screens for hours on end, just watching the blips and making really sure that none of those blips ran into each other. Incredibly boring work, and yet, you know, they really couldn't afford to be distracted by that while they were doing it for hours on end. And it wasn't a surprise that, again, back in the bad old days, that air traffic control centers like that would have big bowls sitting out full of packs of cigarettes, because that's something that would help the air traffic controllers maintain focus for hours on end. The other part of it is once people have used tobacco regularly, then they develop dependence on it, and that brings in a whole cluster of really unpleasant withdrawal symptoms. And my guess is that even 25 years on, you probably have some recollections of what that was like.
I do indeed, which is one reason I would never take a puff of anything for fear of getting right back on it.
You are a very wise man indeed.
Oh, man. Jim and Beaver Dam, do you have a quick comment?
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I'm not sure if this is what y'all wanted as far as input, but back in, I guess it was the 80s and 90s, I had buddies that were smoking, and I helped them quit. The only thing they could use back then was either hypnosis or the gum. And I started getting them to chew on the cloves, whole cloves, and stick that under your tongue. But it would cure the nicotine fit they were having, but it tasted so bad they'd want to put it off as long as they could. So eventually.
I love that that comment. So
yeah, thanks for sharing that, Jim. It's you're right. You must have had some pretty hardcore friends to tolerate cloves like that. But there are people too that find stick cinnamon a little bit more tolerable, but a very intense taste, and that also can help them when they're having a craving.
Jim, thank you for that call, and you can join in too as we talk with our guest, Dr. Doug Jornby, about smoking and quitting tobacco. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Dr. Doug. I'm Larry Mehler for the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at how to quit tobacco on the show today. Larry Mehler here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Dr. Doug Jornby, is Director of Clinical Services for UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's held that role since the center began in 92. So as we talk with Dr. Jornby, I hope you'll join in. What are your questions about quitting smoking? You're wondering how to talk to someone about the tobacco habits they have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And let's take a couple of calls. Nick in Green Bay will go to you first. Nick, hi. Thank you for calling.
I appreciate the doctor's services. That's awesome, because I take the subject pretty dear to my heart, because my uncle, he started smoking when he was 13, and we kind of lost him. But the thing that really frustrated me was he had the cigarette in one hand and the oxygen in the other, and he just couldn't beat it. He tried everything, and the doctor said his lungs were so destroyed that there was nothing they could do. And he went to the ER on Friday, and Sunday he was gone, so it was really quick. But I just don't understand all these tobacco, like CEOs and stuff, and the guys that working in tobacco companies can live with themselves, like, you know, killing people.
Well, comment, Dr. Doug.
Yeah, well, I'm really sorry to hear about you losing your uncle that way. And it sounds like if he was on oxygen, maybe he was suffering from what's called COPD. Is that?
Yeah.
And that's why that is so almost exclusive to people who smoke, and also a really prolonged, difficult way to go. So I'm sorry for him and that your family witnessed that too. It, you know, you mentioned how early in life he started, and that actually is really incredibly common. Up until pretty recently, about 80 to 90% of people who were daily smokers started before they even turned 18. And we have learned in the last several years that there's actually a genetic risk factor that's really kind of quirky, in that it only – there's a type of genetic variant that makes people more likely to become very dependent on nicotine. But it's only triggered if people are exposed to nicotine before the age of 16. Yeah. So unfortunately for your uncle, you know, if he had that risk factor, starting at 13 would put him smack in the middle of that. But it's an incredibly tenacious dependence. I can't count the number of times I've seen folks that were dealing with needing to use supplemental oxygen or cancer or, you know, heart disease that just kept getting worse and worse. And yet, as you said, the cigarette was still in one hand regardless.
Yeah. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Tony in De Pere, the De Pere area, at least. Tony, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, Larry, for taking that call. So my question would be, so I've got an adult son who's probably been a smoker for 15 years or so, and I realize smoking's a choice, although an addictive choice. He's a very intelligent individual, knows all the information, but still kind of associates that smoking habit with those positive experiences or those life experiences that you've talked about. Have you any suggestions for successful ideas in dialogue to talk with them about giving up that smoking? I had a grandparent who, again, experienced that death from smoking for so many years, but now watching my son be addicted to that and not being able to give it up. What kind of thoughts would you have for me sharing information to encourage him to give that up?
Good question. Doug, what do you think?
Well, a couple things come to mind. One is that time may be on your side, in a sense. We know people try to quit at multiple points along the way, and the more often they do that, the more likely they're going to be successful. It also seems like over time, aspects of smoking that were enjoyable for people, you know, maybe when he was younger and started 15 years or so ago, those kind of fade into the background. And it's really common for people in their 30s, 40s, and beyond who will tell us, you know, when I'm talking to them, they don't enjoy anything about smoking anymore. They're just doing it to ward off the withdrawal symptoms. For your son, though, in terms of the things that we know are helpful in helping people quit and stay quit, there are three things that really stand out. And I think you've got one of them on board already, and that's social support, whether that's coming from, you know, family members, friends, loved ones, or people in the healthcare team. All of that is good and is really helpful for people to make the decision to quit and then stick with it, to follow through and be successful. We also know that counseling increases people's chances of quitting successfully in terms of, you know, doing a little problem solving, figuring out, okay, how do you cope with all those different situations where normally you would have lit up a cigarette? And now at, you know, well into your life, as you said, he's been doing that for 15 years. You know, how do you start your car in the morning, or how do you have the first cup of coffee without a cigarette? And then the last one is medicine. And there's actually almost an embarrassment of riches. To go back to what Larry said at the beginning, you know, I've been doing this long enough that when I started, we had nothing to help people other than support and encouragement to get through withdrawal. Everybody was doing it cold turkey. But now there's nicotine replacement therapies. There's a couple of different non-nicotine options out there for people. And it really reduces the unpleasantness of withdrawal. And not surprisingly, that increases people's ability to quit and stay quit. You combine all those things together, and you're talking about increasing people's chances of quitting successfully by about three times what they would be if they just tried to gut it out cold turkey.
And then on the benefits, I remember my Dr. Mike Fiore is telling me that, your body starts improving, immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that we like to do with our clinic, with people who are working in our studies, but we often collect expired carbon monoxide. We have people hold their breath for a few seconds and then exhale into a monitor that measures it. And, you know, someone who's smoking a pack a day of cigarettes typically has anywhere from 20 to 40 or 50 parts per million of carbon monoxide in their system. It binds to the red blood cells much more readily than oxygen does. And the brilliant part is shortly after people quit, like within a couple of days when people are in the worst of withdrawal, if they blow into a carbon monoxide monitor, their CO level has dropped down to 2 to 3 parts per million, which is exactly what a normal, healthy non-smoker would have. And that's incredibly rewarding for a lot of people to see that progress that quickly.
Tony, good luck with your son. Appreciate your call very much. Michael in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to your guest as well. I'm calling as somebody who is currently an active smoker and somebody who is 3+ years into recovery for alcohol dependence. I have a little over 3 years now without a drink.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Just as somebody who has kind of gone through that experience of having an active addiction and something that did get to the point of physical dependency for me, and having, you know, quit drinking multiple times before, you know, kind of finally stuck. I was just wondering if you had anything to share about the importance of somebody with an active addiction being, you know, really kind of ready and determined to kick their addiction, because that was something that was very important for me to kind of finally come to terms with that addiction and be ready to stop.
Yeah. And it sounds like he's ready. Michael's ready.
Yeah, and it would be great to add that success of getting tobacco out of your life to the 3 years of sobriety you have. That's an incredible achievement. And I agree with you that motivation is critical. And we were just talking a few moments ago about, you know, the things that help people. But you can have the best plan in the world. If you don't follow through on it, you can have, you know, the most supportive people in your life. But if you don't want to act on that, and certainly there isn't a medicine, there isn't a patch that provides people with motivation. So when I'm working with somebody, I always want to start out by focusing in on, you know, what's going to be better in their life with cigarettes gone, with tobacco out of their life, and to build on that. That being said, there are an awful lot of people who have, you know, gotten one substance out of their life that learned really important lessons about how that can help them live a smoke-free life. And we've also found out something almost completely by accident, and that is we were talking earlier about how in the early 90s, you know, most hospitals, healthcare facilities allowed smoking anywhere, anytime, and the organization that accredits hospitals and clinics in the mid-90s decided that was not a good look.
And yeah.
So, right. They made them become smoke-free. Interesting thing was, at the time, there was an exception that was written into those guidelines that allowed units or hospitals that were basically psychiatric in nature and or substance abuse treatment facilities. Mm. To basically ignore that. The thought being that, you know, if someone went in a hospital and you said, not only are you not going to drink while you're here, but you can't smoke, that was going to undermine people's success in achieving sobriety. And just because institutions are kind of what they are, an awful lot of places that could have been exempt just said, nope, we're doing this across the board. We're completely smoke-free. And so there was this big nationwide kind of unplanned experiment. And what has come out of that, as people have looked at it carefully in the years since, is not only does making treatment facilities smoke-free not undermine people's ability to stop drinking or stop using other substances, there's also some suggestions that people actually do better, that quitting smoking and the other substances at the same time in a treatment facility leads to better outcomes. So that was kind of an unexpected bonus to some of the smoke-free indoor air acts that came along.
We haven't heard from any women yet, but I know you've published research on treatment for women. And by the way, our previous caller, before we get away from that, I know there's contact information for somebody like him who could really use the services of a clinic. Where do you go to find out, you know, help for getting for quitting?
Sure. There's a couple of great resources that would be available to anyone in the state. We mentioned earlier the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line, which is 1-800-QUIT, Q-U-I-T, now, NOW. They're also available on the web. And the National Cancer Institute in the National Institutes of Health has a text-based program that's available at no cost to anyone in the country, and folks can access that by going to smokefreetext.gov, just one word and .gov, and that will provide additional support texts, and people have the option to talk to a trained counselor if they like, too.
And then, let's see, where was I going after that? I forgot what I was jotting down the information. And by the way, Clara Neipert's probably already got that information, and we'll put it up on the contact information up on our page on today's show. So ideas at WPR.org/Larry. Just go there and we'll get the links for those services that are available. Oh, I know. It was your research on women, a treatment for women. How is quitting smoking different from men and women?
Yeah, and that's a question that we don't have a great answer for at this point. But it does seem like there are some differences that may be important. We do know that women are actually much more likely to make use of treatment resources, whether that's the social support that's helpful to folks, or engaging in some kind of formal counseling to get some problem solving and support. We even see that in some of the clinical research studies that I have done, where it's not a huge effect, but there's always a little bit over half of the folks who volunteer for treatment studies like that are women, a little bit more likely to make a planful effort with other people. It also, although the data aren't so clear with this, it does seem like in several cases, women seem to have a better response to some of the non-nicotine medicines to help them quit smoking than the nicotine replacement.
Interesting. Linda in Appleton wonders if the inhalation of marijuana has the same effect on your lungs and et cetera as smoking.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's actually something that we are looking at much more closely. Particularly as, cannabis use is legalized or decriminalized in more and more states in the U.S. Kind of traditionally, it's been a trade-off in terms of how we've looked at lung risk. Typically, when people were smoking cannabis, they weren't filters or anything like that, and they tended to hold the smoke into their lungs longer than, say, a typical cigarette smoker would be, which sort of pushes it in the direction of more harm. Definitely, there's carbon monoxide involved with smoking either substance, because it's not about the substance, it's the combustion. But again, traditionally, people who were using cannabis didn't use it as often as tobacco smokers who might be smoking, one, two, sometimes three packs a day. So the exposure went down, and that pushed things in the other direction. And now, of course, with just the wide variety of cannabis products or cannabis-adjacent products that are out there, people can vape, people can eat. There's a whole bunch of different ways that don't have any of that combustible risk that tobacco and I guess, if you will, the old school joint shared.
Yeah, and you mentioned vaping, and that I know, or I think I know, that that, tell me if I'm wrong or not, that while cigarette smoking dropped in teens, then this vaping business increased.
Yes, yeah, quite a bit. To the point where just before the pandemic kind of upended everything, cigarette smoking among adolescents was actually at an all-time low, but vaping had gone up quite a bit. Since then, in addition to the pandemic, there have been a couple things that took place, partly in a reaction to how quickly vaping was being taken on by adolescents. The national tobacco purchase age was raised to 21 and that included vape products. And we're still looking at the ramifications of that. And then also there were some efforts to that are still ongoing at this point to eliminate flavored e-juice, the idea being that that was particularly appealing to young people, folks who had never smoked tobacco. And some of that stuff is still being tussled out in courts around the country, but increasingly it looks like it will be harder and harder for people to vape nicotine with flavors, you know, resembling fruit or sugary breakfast cereals, or there's a whole range of those out there.
Oh, man. Well, Bert in Stillwater, Minnesota said his doctor recommended that he break dry spaghetti into cigarette length and carry them with him. So he had something to fiddle with when he was quitting, something between his fingers or lips. And he'd take out one of his edible toothpicks.
I'll be honest. I have not heard the pasta one in a long time. I will have to share that with Dr. Fiore because he'll appreciate it. I'm much less Italian, and so my go-to for people is usually drinking straws. You can cut a piece of drinking straw so it's exactly the same length as a cigarette, and not only can you fiddle with it, but a lot of people find that by inhaling through the straw, it reminds them a little bit of taking a puff, and that can be helpful with an urge, too. But I really like the pasta. That's a great one.
If I get caught sometimes in the, I would just, and it's easy to do, I just hold my breath.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you hold it as long as you can, and that has a similar sensation.
May I turn the tables and ask you, Larry, looking back over 25 years of being smoke-free, what do you like the most? What's the best about that for you?
Well, there's no coughing in the morning, yeah. And clearing of the throat. I do a 3-mile jog in the morning, or kind of a fast walk and jog, and I don't have to worry when I go anywhere about where can I find a place to smoke, and my clothes don't smell, and there are so many and in relationships with others.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
The biggest one, probably.
That's incredible.
So I had a whole bunch of them. I tell you what, Doug, I am so happy to have you with us today, and hopefully we can do this again down the road. It's kind of a time of year when people want to quit, and it's nice to have you talk about it. And again, Clara Neipert tells me that we've got those links, those various links up for help on quitting smoking up on our Larry Mueller show. Go to today's date, ideas@WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date and you'll find that information again. Doug, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure, and congratulations again. Yeah.
Dr. Doug Jorenby, our guest director of clinical services for UW-Madison Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but go to those services. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Lots more in store.